You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko shi zang toku ingoa. Nau mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnē rā. Kia ora, welcome to the Monday Wire for Rahina Monday, the 25th of November. I'm Shira, your host, and I'm with producers Deb and Loi. Let me just pop on those mics. Hey guys, how's the team?
Hello.
Kia ora.
It's a new team today because it used to be me, Jemima and Lachlan.
Yes.
But, new Monday team.
Out. Big boots to fill.
Big boots. Big shoes, right?
Big shoes.
Smelly
yes.
shoes.
Yes. Big. Oof. big Very shoes. Smelly indeed.
Yeah. Well, how you guys been? How you guys feeling for our first session as a team?
Oh, pumped, exciting. Can't wait to just dive straight in and get amongst it, really.
No tears yet, right?
No tears.
Okay, great. Well, if I can, coming up on the show today, we have our weekly chat with Green Party co-leader James Shaw, this week on prisoner voting rights, ACC fossil fuel divestment, APEC bill, and we touch a little bit on the budget. We have Danone, who's helped out, and he's spoken to Rob McCann on White Ribbon Day, and I speak to Behrouz Bakani, author of No Friend But the Mountains, on his experience of being detained on Manus Island for 6 years as a refugee. And finally, Louis speaks to Alexander Plum on working households in poverty. He aha o whakaro, if you have any thoughts to share throughout the show, we would love to hear from you. Tuki pātui mai, send through a text to 5395, or wire mai, you can call in the studio to chat with us on 309 3879. And don't forget, we've also got the gram that Deb has been working hard at, right?
Yeah, thanks.
And our Twitter at 95BFM News. Oh.
It's time to hear from the Green Party with co-leader James Shaw.
This week I spoke to Green Party co-leader James Shaw about a few different things. We discussed the call from the Green Party for ACC to divest from fossil fuels, the APEC bill, and we touched briefly on the budget and the Public Finance Act. Also earlier, Justice Minister Andrew Little has also recently announced that the government will be reversing the 2010 prisoner ban after both the Supreme Court found it inconsistent with the Bill of Rights and the Waitangi Tribunal found it in breach of treaty principles. I begin by asking James on the background to overturning the ban to now allow prisoners with an under 3 year sentence to vote.
Well, what this does is it reverses a law change that National brought in when they were in government a few years ago. And what they did was they put a complete ban on prisoners being allowed to vote. Now, under the old system, people who were serving a sentence of more than 3 years weren't allowed to vote, but people who were serving a sentence of less than 3 years were. And so what we're doing is we're simply winding back the clock to the original state of affairs.
Because this is followed after a Supreme Court decision upheld, I guess, a declaration that was inconsistent with the Bill of Rights and fundamental freedoms. At the same time, though, with this law change, there's still that argument coming from National side that they're going to keep the 2010 amendment when the next election comes around. And so what's your response to, I guess, National's argument that it's a right that should be breached?
Well, I would say that National have always been kind of pretty weak on human rights. It is the right to vote is a fundamental human right, and going to prison is the punishment that you have for breaking the law. And it doesn't justify other breaches of human rights.
I'll move on to there's a report that just came out from the Green Party on calling for the ACC to divest from fossil fuels. Could you talk to me a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, this came off the back of a select committee report that my colleague Chloe Swarbrick initiated. And, you know, the ACC has got hundreds of millions of dollars invested in the fossil fuel industry, whilst the New Zealand Superannuation Fund has actually divested from all but a tiny amount of fossil fuel investments over the course of the last few years. And so what the Green Party is saying is, well, at the very least, the ACC fund, which is the largest fund that we've got, should at least follow the lead of the super fund and take the sort of risk-based approach and get out of fossil fuels.
However, ACC's argument, I guess, or they're defending them, the investment, is that they're saying that it's not unethical that they're investing in fossil fuels?
Well, I mean, previously they got out of tobacco, and tobacco is still legal, whereas what they're arguing is that fossil fuel investments are legal, and therefore they should be allowed to continue to invest in them. But a couple of weeks ago, of course, Parliament passed a law saying that we wanted to be carbon zero by 2050 at the latest, and you know, we know that fossil fuels are warming the climate and causing a significant amount of human misery, and that will continue into the into the future. And so whether or not fossil fuels are legal, there is an ethical question about whether they should be invested in them. And like I said, I think that they should follow the lead that the New Zealand Superannuation Fund set a few years ago and take a risk-based approach and reduce their commitments to the fossil fuel industry.
Is it fair to say that ACC has had a history of investing in schemes that might have been unethical?
Well, I mean, I guess their argument would be that, you know, the public perception of what is ethical changes over time, and it's also not a fixed point, right? Is that, you know, there will be a kind of a group of activities that people consider to be unethical, and so that changes over time. I would just say when it comes to fossil fuels that they're behind the eight ball and that public opinion has definitely moved on that.
And then the next thing was the AEPC bill, which is also something that the Green Party is against.
Oh, the APEC. Yeah.
APEC, yeah.
Yeah, so this is a law change that is temporary, but it basically allows for expanded powers for New Zealand police, but also for foreign security agents who would be accompanying their kind of governmental representatives, and enables them to essentially carry open guns whilst they're here. And in our view, that's a step too far, and actually New Zealand laws should be adequate for that.
So what currently are the regulations around being able to carry firearms in terms of positions of security or police or enforcement?
Well, security can't. Only the police can, and then the police have. It's complicated. There's sort of a range of restrictions that they have, but generally they don't carry open firearms. What this bill would do is that it would simply expand that to enable them to carry firearms openly. But the thing that we're particularly concerned about is the idea that actually you're going to have security agents for foreign governments in New Zealand and able to carry weapons.
Another concern I saw that was the use of wireless electronic technology.
It's about countermeasures.
Right.
So the idea is it's sort of part of a surveillance package, and essentially what we're worried about is that it would enable those security services from foreign governments to, basically carry, surveillance activities here in New Zealand.
I hope it's all right that I asked you a little bit about the Public Finance Act. Is that something that you're happy to talk to about today?
Sure.
Yeah.
There is.
I guess the question is, so the Public Finance Act, I guess, puts on really strict debt limitations, and then there's obviously been a lot of talk on what the budget's going to be used on. So I was wondering if you had any feelings or thoughts on the fact.
The Public Finance Act itself doesn't contain any limitations on debt, but what it does say is that a government has to lay out a fiscal strategy that includes its policies on debt, for example, amongst other things. And so what the intention of the Act is to do is to provide some kind of transparency and predictability to the public by saying, look, this government's view of debt is either restrictive or it's expansive and so on. So that's actually all it does, is require governments to have a publicly published strategy around debt. The thing is that in New Zealand, we have operated historically with very low levels of debt, particularly if you compare ourselves to other OECD countries. That, of course, went up after the GFC and the Christchurch earthquake, which were both very expensive, and then have come down to just under 20% of gross domestic product. And there are calls at the moment, particularly because the international economy is slowing down because of things like the trade war between the US and China, and also because we've recognised that actually in New Zealand we have a huge infrastructure and housing deficit, and debt is incredibly cheap. It's actually the cheapest it's ever been in history, and so it kind of makes sense to have a more expansive view of it now in order to fund, housing and infrastructure.
Is there a general trend towards changing the debt limits and then allowing more spending to occur?
Well, that's should we just say that's a live matter for debate inside the government at the moment.
That was Green Party co-leader James Shaw, and we'll be back after a break.
That was James Shaw for the Green Party. The Wire.
The reality is that we don't have widespread security for te reo Māori. We have one country that has the responsibility and opportunity to save te reo. And in terms of critical mass, there is no way that we can say te reo Māori is safe.
Rediscovering Aotearoa, a decolonisation series from ReNews. Travelling Aotearoa, meeting young Kiwis and discussing the impacts of colonisation, modern race relations and their own self-decolonisation. Rediscovering Aotearoa. Watch, listen and read on ReNews.com. co.nz. Proudly brought to you by New Zealand On Air.
Yes, I am. The rhythm is like jamming on. Every Monday night from 9 till 11, Dobbit and Disselectors play the full range of ghetto sound. Yeah, man. From rock steady to roots reggae, beat bam sound to hip hop. Dub style, true to the latest dancehall vibes. Yeah, man, the rhythm selection. Boy, the rhythm selection. The rhythm selection. Boy, from 9 to 11 and 95 FM. Dub it and get selectors. The rhythm selection.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. We've got a piece from Danone that Deb's going to help out with.
Yeah, Danone spoke.
Oh, hold up. I'm just going to turn on the mic for Deb.
Hi, thanks. So Danone spoke with White Ribbon New Zealand's manager, Rob McCann, at the national branch of an international organisation dealing with ending male domestic violence. White Ribbon commissioned some remarkable research on prevalent male stereotypes in Aotearoa, and the contributing factor to exceptionally high rates of domestic violence here. Danone starts by asking more details about White Ribbon, how they operate and how Rob is key to the organisation.
So White Ribbon is an international campaign that is about ending men's violence towards women. And in New Zealand, we run that campaign all throughout the year with a special focus on November and on White Ribbon Day, which is November the 25th. So this year we're focusing on asking people to challenge those unspoken rules, such as boys don't cry, or people should man up or toughen up, harden up, things like that that help create unhealthy masculinity. So we're really trying to get to a point where we're starting to undermine those things that help create men who aren't able to deal with their emotions or aren't able to express themselves and effectively take part in what we call respectful relationships, which is a protection against violence. So that's a little of what we do.
Oh, yes. That sounds very good. So are you saying there's a strong correlation between domestic violence and people, men being conditioned towards these stereotypes?
Yeah, so what we know is that violence is not just about people getting angry. That's often what we think when we look at anger. But actually, it's about people using power and control in relationships. So we're not talking about when everyday people have an argument and behave in a bad manner. We're talking about when people use violence, whether it's physical or psychological, on a day-in, day-out basis to control their partner and get what they want. And what we find is that is behavior that's often learned. We can learn it from our parents, through society, through our friends and colleagues. And that type of behaviour helps to create young men that really struggle to have those respectful relationships, because they've learnt by watching a parent or whatever it is, they've learnt that they can get what they want by behaving in this way and using violence. So that is one of the things that we're trying to undo by this campaign, getting people to realise that using those old clichés like harden up are really, really hurtful and don't help to create young men that are going to function well in relationships.
All right, so how would a man that has noticed they've had these tendencies reparent themselves or uncondition themselves towards a more healthier form of masculinity?
That's a really good question. And the first thing is probably talking to other men and other people in your life so they can start to unpack that for you. Because the reality is, this is not something that as men we're very good about, we're very good at talking about. So you'll find that there'll be plenty of your mates, plenty of your friends who haven't lived that particular life, and they'll be able to help you out. If your problem is more serious, then you need to go online and look up a course where you can go through anger management and go through a course that helps you understand those feelings and behaviours and what's driving them, what's unacceptable.
I see. I also know New Zealand has the highest male suicide rate, I believe, in the developed world. Do you feel like some of that is due to us not being able to unpack our feelings, that conditioning you talked about hardening up, which really stifles our ability to reach out?
There's absolutely no doubt that what we're talking about is really unhealthy for men. The links between suicide and this type of thing, you're going to have to talk to people who are experts in that area. But there's no doubt that it's really unhealthy for men not to be able to express their feelings and unpack these emotions. If you bottle them up, if you think that you're alone in the world, those things are very, very hard on your own mental health. There's absolutely no doubt about that. And we are, and unfortunately we have a record here, we have the highest rate of reported violence towards women in the developed world. So there is something seriously wrong in our country that we need to undo before we get better.
In your opinion, what do you think the root of this is? Where do you think this strong conditioning comes from? Because I know New Zealand, we like to promote ourselves as quite open, welcoming and accepting as a society.
Well, look, I'm not a young man anymore. I turned 50 this year, and I know that when I grew up, my dad didn't hug me as much as, you know, I hug my kids, because it wasn't the dumb thing to do. We were conditioned as young boys to hold our emotions in, and men tended to be less emotional than hopefully our young men are today. I know that when I watched rugby as a young boy, our All Blacks didn't cry or show emotion. If their testicle was pulled out, they kept playing. If their arm was broken, they kept playing. And you didn't show any pain or any hurt. Those things were all around us. Men had to be tough and strong, and stoic was a big word from my generation. And all of that stuff is incredibly unhelpful. And we also had a terrible culture within New Zealand of excess and drinking, which probably didn't help home lives back in the day. And as a country, you know, you only have to go back just over 100 years and women didn't have the vote. At various times, there was not rape within marriage. So as a, you know, our laws treated women as property. So there are a lot of attitudes that we as a country have to get rid of, and the law changes have helped drive some of that, but so have attitudinal changes around how we view women. And obviously we should be viewing them as equals and our partners rather than property or things that we should control. And those attitudes still exist, unfortunately.
I'm quite curious, what does healthy masculinity look like? Because when I associate the idea of masculinity, I associate it with dominant role models and those traditional figures you talked about. So I'm very curious how a healthy masculine man looks like, that's in touch with his emotions and is able to communicate without resorting to violence and stuff.
I actually think you started to describe it right there, as in touch with their emotions. So healthy masculinity should be about being kind and empathetic, finding peaceful resolutions to problems. It's about being confident in who you are, not what society suddenly wants you to be from an advert or a stereotype. So you should be able to express emotions, whether it's joy or sadness. You should be able to enjoy a whole range of activities, from, you know, what we were once expected to enjoy, just cricket and rugby, to also cooking, dancing, gardening, or anything else that you think you enjoy. That's part of healthy masculinity, being confident in yourself to be all of those things and being loving and kind.
Have the rates of domestic violence in New Zealand begun to decrease? Because just based off my layman understanding, I feel as though our masculine figures have adapted a bit. They've become more receptive towards these ideas.
One of the key things there is the more that a behaviour becomes unacceptable, the more people are likely to say, look, I'm not going to put up with that and report it. The more our police are trusted in the areas of domestic violence and now sexual violence, the more people are likely to go and report those crimes. So no, I'm not going to suggest or even think that the rates of family violence or sexual violence are going to go down in the near future. Because campaigns like us and It's Not Okay and the work that Women's Refuge and Shine and everyone does is probably going to drive up those rates as more and more people go, this behaviour is unacceptable. I mean, it's commonly accepted at the moment that only around 20% of family violence is actually reported. So if we're starting to scratch that other 80%, I think we're likely to see family violence increase. And there's another thing here we haven't touched on at all, is that when I grew up, one of the things that perhaps wasn't healthy was pornography, which might have been a magazine under the bed. But for the generations coming through now, there is full-on access to pornography everywhere on every device, and it's freely available. And while it might have been unhealthy in my day, say, it is now very unhealthy because a lot of young men don't understand that it isn't real, that that is not how you should treat a woman. And we're seeing more and more sexual violence and violence involved in those videos and images, which leads young men to think that's normal behaviour and that's what they should be doing, and young women to go, well, that's the way of the world and that's what I have to put up with. It's very, very unhealthy stuff, and we're seeing surveys that we haven't been able to conduct in New Zealand where there are more excuses for rape culture and the attitudes that go with it in Australia. And there's no research that proves it, but one conclusion is that the negative pressures of this new aspect of society are actually increasing the amount of violence that's out there and potential for violence.
So despite that there's social progress, we're still sort of bombarded by these very unbalanced power dynamics in pornography and media and our role models, and that sort of offsets the progress we're having at the individual level. So at the cultural level, our society is still quite patriarchal and quite, I suppose, violent in that way.
Yeah, I think that's a fair statement. It's very hard to prove, and apologies, I'm in an airport at the moment, making a few messages. I think it's really hard to statistically prove any of that, but if you were looking around for a conclusion, I think you've hit the nail on the head.
I see. Rob, thank you so much for giving your time. Just for a last note, can you give me some more information about White Ribbon Day and how somebody that might want to take part can take part?
Absolutely. Head on over to our website, www.whiteribbon.org.nz, and you'll find that all our resources are freely available. So there are videos on actions that you can take. There are also written documents called the Toolbox, which show you how to do a whole range of different things, whether it's have those conversations with your children about pornography, or when to talk about respectful relationships, or how to intervene in someone's violence. It's all there on our website, or you can head on to the website and go to the shop and purchase a white ribbon or something like that. Or you can actually even take a step further. If you're in a business, you can become White Ribbon accredited. It doesn't cost anything. It's about getting businesses involved. Or you can become a White Ribbon ambassador and go through an online course and help us promote these messages in your community.
That was Rob McCann. Between 33 to 39% of Kiwi women will experience domestic and or sexual violence in New Zealand. White Ribbon hopes to support more research into the broader framework of gender constructions in Aotearoa to help understand the prevalence of violence.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
Since 1992, Australia has had a policy of mandatory immigration detention. All non-citizens without a valid visa are detained until they're granted a visa or leave the country. Therefore, hundreds of refugee and asylum seekers are sent to detention centres located in Papua New Guinea, Oneiru and Manus Island. The conditions have been described by refugees as prison-like. Mental health issues such as self-harm, suicide, stress, anxiety and depression are particularly of concern for the refugees. However, access to healthcare and support is difficult. Most refugees have now been moved to Port Moresby on Papua New Guinea. Dozens are at Gransville Hotel, transferred there for medical treatment, which was unavailable on Manus Island. While some non-refugees have left voluntarily and others have been sent home, an estimated 100 or so men remain in Papua New Guinea, unable to be deported because their country of citizenship refuses to accept involuntary returns. Behrouz Bukhani was detained on Manus Island for 6 years after fleeing Iran due to his work in journalism. He wrote a book, No Friend But the Mountains, while in the detention centre, smuggling out PDFs on WhatsApp. Earlier this month, he left Manus Island for the first time to travel to New Zealand. I caught up with him and he says he was quite tired when I rang, flying from Auckland to Christchurch, and hadn't had much time to himself yet due to all the interviews. We talked about the power of language in upholding inhumane structures, and his criticism of Australia's refugee policy, and the power of storytelling and journalism to expose and reshape narratives. I begin by asking him on his experience on Manus Island.
Yeah, actually, it's a big question. You know, my experience in Manus Island, so I have been, you know, writing and creating just to express myself and describe the situation there and, you know, expose the system. So for years and years, so I think it is very hard to answer this question in a short time and in few words. But of course it was terrible and so hard, because, you know, it's really hard to live in a place as a, you know, for exile, you know, we were in exile. And now that I'm talking with you, many of the men remain, so we don't know what will happen for them. You know, of course, they are not in Manus, but they are in Port Moresby, and some people in Nauru. So we don't know what is the next for them and what will happen for them. So, of course, it's so hard, you know. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Very, inhuman and very unnecessary exile policy, and very, you know, unacceptable.
Because it's so great that we were able to hear your experience from Manus Island, but I'm sure there are thousands of other people who are still in the detention centres.
Yeah, in Australia and in Manus and Nauru. So in Port Moresby, there are, I think, 250 people, and 50 of them are in prison right now, a real prison, and 200 people in Nauru. And so, yeah, many people in detention in Australia.
Mm. You described the detention centres as basically a prison.
Yeah, actually it was a prison, and worse than a prison. So we were in that place for 3 years, 4.5 years. Then they relocated us to a new place, and we were there for about 2 years. So 6 years we were in that place. And for me, you know, using language and words is very important. And I didn't want to use the word and concept that created by Australian government, you know. So that's why, you know, for us in that place, you know, prison was the best word, although I think it is not an enough word, and it's not, you know, actually, we should find another word, but because that place was worse than a prison. So, yeah, I didn't want to use the language of the government.
I wanted to ask about the power of words and language. What do you think the way we talk about migration or refugees or even us versus other people, how do you think language shapes the way we understand our relationships with people who are in difficult situations?
Yeah, you know, language is, we should create a language and use a language that is not the language of the system, because the system has this power to inject this language, these words and concept into the society. And so I think we should create some words and concept to represent our situation, and also we should use some words to don't reduce people to only reduce them and take the humanity, you know. And that's why I think we should be careful with the words that we use. So definitely, you know, the language of the government and the system is so, I think, horrible in some ways, and in some ways is, you know, just reduce people, you know, and or assault people. So that's why we should be careful with the words and don't reduce people.
Yeah. Do you have any criticisms on the way the Australian policy reduces the humanity of people, because they have quite a protectionist regime, I guess?
I think, you know, what I understand from the politics in Australia is that, you know, actually this exile policy, you know, sending innocent people to remote places, you know, and keep children in indefinite detention and innocent people in the indefinite detention. Of course, it is a fascistic policy, and it is with a fascism culture. So it is definitely, you know, you cannot, you know, justify violation human rights, you know, and say that we do this because of, you know, national security. It is a big lie, you know, it is a big lie. And I think Australian government has used innocent people such as the refugees for its political benefits and, you know, to manipulate Australian people and keep control, you know, on the country. And, you know, it is a big lie. It is one of the biggest lie in the history of Australia, that keeping people in remote prisons is because of national security. It is a big lie. You know, we were only just hundreds innocent people, you know, women, child, and, you know, so. And they have, you know, all of the countries around the world, they have a system to process people and find out that, you know, why we left our countries. So I think it is not an answer to, you know, protecting borders or, you know, to refugee crisis. Yeah. So it's, yeah, definitely history makes judge about this period and about the Australian government. Although right now I think they lost their credit in internationally.
Mm. I wanted to ask about, I guess, the experience of women and children in these detention centres and these prisons, basically.
Yeah, actually, in Manus, all of the people were men, so, but the families were in Nauru. So they kept the children in indefinite detention, I think, for years. Yeah, I think four years. And then, you know, there was too much pressure on the government. Finally, they let those kids off Nauru. But still, you know, some women remain there. And so, but, you know, I don't think, you know, even keeping kids in the indefinite detention for a day, you know, is acceptable, you know, in, even for a moment, you know. And when a country is doing this, you know, actually that shows that that country forgets about the principles, about morality and humanity. You know, that should never happen, to keep innocent people in indefinite detention and justify that to the public. You know, that's, yeah, it's horrible. It's horrible. And, you know, I don't think that people with good heart accept this. You know, it's totally unacceptable.
Mm. Because do you know why Australia rejected New Zealand's offer to take in more refugees?
Yeah, so, you know, right now the New Zealand government, you know, many times offer this, that they can take, you know, 150 people. And Australia always, you know, using this for its political benefits, you know, they say, I don't know, you know, right now I'm in New Zealand, so it is a, you know, I don't think that Australia is better than New Zealand. I mean, so New Zealand is a good country, and but the Australian government say that if we accept this offer, you know, they use New Zealand as a backdoor, which is ridiculous, you know, which is ridiculous. And, you know, when they are under too much pressure, they said, oh, we consider this offer. But when, you know, they feel relieved, they said, oh, okay, we cannot do that. We don't want to do that. And just, the, you know, so hopefully, really, hopefully that New Zealand government, you know, has negotiation with PNG directly and with Nauru and take those people who remain, you know. Hopefully New Zealand take leadership and solve this problem.
I also wanted to ask how you felt about the place of the book you've written, because Australia has awarded it such a prestigious prize, yet at the same time has very, very inhumane policies and are still detaining so many hundreds of other asylum seekers, refugees, in these camps. How does that feel?
Actually, you know, I think, so this book and now my movie, I think, you know, many people in Australia read this book, and, you know, I think this award, or, you know, some other awards that I received, I think it is a resistance of civil society and literature community against this system. You know, we should understand it in this way, that actually they are resisting front of this system, front of this government that, you know, is actually treating the democracy, treating the democratic values. So that's why I think we we should understand it in this way. So, in fact, they, by giving this award, they showed and they proved that they are not happy, they are not angry with what the government has done. You know, and, you know, I think, unfortunately, this liberal government actually damaged Australia internationally, damaged democratic values, and damaged the society. So civil society is resisting in front of this. So that giving that award, I think we should understand in that way.
Mm. What are you hoping to achieve with the film? What do you think the power of film is different to a book?
Actually, the film, you were talking about the film.
Yes.
Actually, you know, in my view, the film is important than the book, because this book, the movie was very successful, you know. We reached to international film festivals, even in New Zealand. You know, we had still, we have many screening in the universities around the world, you know, in Europe, in America, everywhere. We are showing this movie to people, to the students. And, you know, in my view, my understanding is that, you know, this movie is important. Yeah, it's very important because actually recorded. You know, that prison that we were was demolished later, so it doesn't exist anymore. So we have this movie, you know, and you can hear the stories of people directly. And also it is about the local people, about, you know, Manusian people. And so I think it's very important. Yeah, you know, historically is important.
How were the logistics of writing the story? Because you basically use WhatsApp messages to smuggle the story out. How was it doing that?
So I think, you know, many people say this, but for me, you know, if you use your phone, you know, after a while if someone give you a computer, you cannot work in the computer, you know. And, you know, I have a computer for 2 months. Yeah, but I didn't use it yet. But I think I should change this and try to use my computer rather than my phone. So I think it's not a big thing, you know, for you people who were free and you use your computer. I think it's quite strange, but for me and for people in Manus, you know, I think it's not a strange thing, yeah, it's not unbelievable thing, yeah, I think, yeah.
Yeah, and my final question is, you used to be, so you were a journalist before,
yeah.
And so I wanted to ask what your relationship is and how you feel, how important is it to get stories out there and to have these discussions? How do you feel about that?
You know, at the first day I arrived in Manus, actually I didn't arrive, they sent me to Manus. So I thought that, you know, it was always I have this feeling that it is like my duty to expose this. It's my duty to, you know, tell this story because it is an untold story. And, you know, that's why I actually start to work to create this way. And, you know, and right now many of the refugees share their stories, many of people. And I think it's important, 65 million people you know, refugees, and it is a big number of people. So I'm happy right now because actually it was, of course, definitely before me, you know, many refugees shared their stories, but I'm happy that I had a small role to create this way, other people be, you know, encourage people to write and share their stories, because it is a part of the history that actually it is unwritten, it is not a part of the official history. So that's why I think it's important. So I, as a journalist and writer, I did my best just to expose this system.
Yeah.
So even history will make judge about these materials that I create.
Yeah, I wondered what do you hope, or what do you suggest is the best way to break down harmful systems that, I guess, indoctrinate people in a certain way of thinking that means that they feel it's justified to do these inhumane actions. How do we break that down?
I think, you know, the short way is election. You know, in liberal democracy, we have a, you know, election, you know. So people can make the decision, you know, and change the government very easily through the election and, you know, actually, like, dominate the, you know, the opinion, public opinion, you know, force the government, force the power structure to follow the principles. So because the power always is dangerous, you know, you should always struggle against the power to keep it, you know, accountable. They, you know, always should answer to the public. So I think the best way and the only way, perhaps, is just changing these systems through election. So we can do, I think anyone is responsible about politics and about the society. So if everyone be active and do a small thing, I think we can change. But of course, it is a general question. It's very hard to answer.
It's a big, big question. That was Behrouz Bakani, and we also just had someone text in who says that they agree the refugee policies in Australia need work, but what they're confused about or trying to understand is why one of our biggest trading partners is allegedly holding people in the millions. Same program, two comparing stories, one of which we will hear later on the show. Is it because it's closer to home? In perspective, the quantity of people doesn't even compare. So I guess this person's wondering the issue of terms of China and China's mass internment of Uyghur Muslims, and the fact that we hear much more about Australia's issue and China's issue, and I guess it's just like they're both justified issues. But yeah, we'll move on to. So yeah, thanks for texting in. I think they're both valid questions and complex issues. And next we've got Louis' piece coming up.
The Wire.
It is no secret that poverty is a prevalent issue in Aotearoa, with the narrative often around inequality amongst our most vulnerable communities. Well, new research conducted by AUT's Work Research Institute has found that more than 50,000 working households are living in poverty across New Zealand. This report was commissioned by the Human Rights Commission, who will analyse these implications identified through the findings to inform their advocacy work focusing on poverty, equality and non-discrimination. I spoke with Dr. Alexander Plum, a senior research fellow, at the NZ Work Research Institute, who are an inquiry-driven research team that analyse and explore issues affecting people and their work. Here he is talking with me about inequality amongst our working-class households.
The study looks at inequality. Kind of, there's a great discussion on inequality in general, but there's also a shift in the focus, asking whether employment itself is sufficient to prevent the household from facing poverty. And that's actually the focus of our study, is looking at what is the proportion of households in New Zealand that are working and are still facing poverty. And for that study, we used the 2013 census and linked them with some income records, and we found that out of the 725,000 working households, about 50,000 households face poverty in New Zealand.
So what is the extent and the characteristics of working households that are living in poverty?
So the characteristics, when we look at this, at the distributional dimension, we find that it is pretty heterogeneous. So there are some pockets which have an elevated inward poverty risk, for example, single parents households. When we find that in general 7% of the working households face poverty, among the single parents households we find that this number is at 12.3%. Also, with respect to Pacific peoples and Maori households, we find an elevated risk. And there are also other dimensions. For example, if one of the members is disabled, we find a higher inward poverty risk, or when the family size is higher, which is like also a technical aspect, because money needs to be spread across more members in the household.
One of the key figures shown in the report is the little change in the working poverty rates from 2007 until 2017. What's been happening for the last decade that has caused little to no change?
That's actually a really good question, and we haven't delved too much into trying to answer that one. So this is a bit of an open research question. When we look in general at inequality figures, we find that these are pretty stable during that time period. So this is pretty much in line with what we find on the overall level. Where we find that there's a bit of movement going on, if you look at how things happen, if you account for working for family tax credit or accommodation supplement, there you can see that during the crisis in 2007, when you not account for these income sources, the inward poverty rate actually would be higher, and we see that there's a cushioning effect due to these additional income sources.
One of the things that I found really interesting myself surrounding this report was the narrative that we have on this idea of poverty in New Zealand. You know, we don't see this side usually of the working class citizens struggling, you know, to get by, disproportionately affected. People fall in and out of poverty all the time depending on the month or the working week. So what are some of the misconceptions around poverty in Aotearoa?
It's kind of interesting, and that's true. It's kind of what must be kept in mind is that the structure of poverty is something different between those in work and those who are not in work. When we look at a annual level and look how many months actually those households face poverty, then we see that those households that are not in work actually face most of the month in poverty, while this is not really the case for working households. So there's a bit of movement in and out of poverty, which makes the risk a bit different. Still, there's a certain portion which has an elevated inward poverty risk. And I think it needs to be looked much closer to the specific circumstances a household faces, which might drive the risk of facing inward poverty. And I think next steps would be to look what are potential policy tools to address that if it's considered as necessary.
Another question I have just around these misconceptions is our vulnerable communities. I mean, these communities are affected disproportionately by this figure.
That's true. So like I said in the introduction, like Pacific peoples and Maori households, they have an elevated risk.
The rest of Louise's piece will be podcast, just because we're running out of time today. Thanks so much to everyone who's spoken. Thanks to everyone who's spoken, and thanks for Louis, Deb and Danoon for helping me produce.
That was The Wire.
And so tune in next... There we go. Tune in next week, Monday, with me, Sherry, and Deb, and Louis. And now it's for the 1-4 with Penny.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.